Good evening. This is Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio, and we're glad you're joining us. Tonight's program is made possible in part by the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. I'm Cliff Shackelford, the host of Bird Calls since June of 2013, and tonight marks our 12th anniversary of being on the air. We were a little delayed because of technical difficulties, but we're here and we're having a good 12th anniversary episode. Soon I'll be ready to take your calls and discuss birds. Let's hear from you by calling us at 800-552-8502. Again, that number is 800-552-8502. So we're going to start off with a recap of last month's conservation tip, which I think some people may have, you know, wondered why a bird watcher would recommend you buy a hunting and fishing license. And the reason is it's super dedicated funding for conservation at the state level. That's the key. And bird watchers and wildlife viewers in general don't really have that annual way of guaranteed funding that goes into habitat restoration. The money goes into data collection and analysis by state agency biologists, and it also enhances access to properties for the users. So buy a permit also to access your state wildlife management area, what we call WMAs. Some states offer a non-consumptive permit, and so we found that in Texas, using Parks and Wildlife data, there's six times more WMA permits sold to hunters than to non-consumptive users. And so what I recommend is you study the calendar to see when game species are in season so you can avoid crowds. And also if you study seasons and bag limits, you can help your local game warden who's enforcing game laws. That way, if you see poaching is happening, you can help out. So these are state-owned lands, WMA, so you want to contact your state's Game and Fish Agency or your DNR to find out more how you can help with this dedicated funding at the state level that helps conservation and helps non-game birds as well as game birds. Okay, we're going to get into our profile species. We're going to look at the hooded warbler. In today's episode, we're going to profile a thicket-loving songbird that sings the following song. Sounds like it's saying tweet tweet tweetio. Tweet tweet tweetio. The use of mnemonics can help us remember bird songs, and some sources use these three words that I just said for the hooded warbler: weet weet weetio, or weet a weet a weetio. As a teen birder learning bird song long before the internet or amassing bird books, I learned this song as the bird in the thick shrubs that sounded like it was sneezing, as in ha ha hachu, ha ha hachu. So whatever works for you. This tiny and active warbler likes to be in dense understory, making it more often heard than seen. The male is all over yellow and sports the namesake hood, which to me looks like a bold black open-faced ski mask. The female lacks the bold ski mask, but some individuals can have small hints or a dusting of the ski mask, especially on the crown. Both sexes have white tail feathers that they often flick and flash while foraging about in the vegetation. The breeding range of this migratory species includes all of the southeastern U.S. and north up the east coast to New York and Massachusetts. In the Great Lakes, the species is very spotty and local. Except for individuals in southern Ontario, Canada, this species is almost a U.S. endemic as a breeding species. In winter, however, they depart south for Mexico and all of Central America, plus Cuba and many Caribbean islands. Hooded warblers are primarily insectivorous and will eat spiders and other invertebrates. While foraging, they often exhibit what's called hawking, which means they take short bouts of flight after tasty insects they've flushed that are trying to get away. Thankfully, the hooded warbler is one species that's not declining, according to a half century of data collected and analyzed by the North American Breeding Bird Survey. To see a photo of a hooded warbler snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls webpage at redriverradio.org. The hooded warbler, he's one of my favorites. I really like about the second or third week of March when they start marching back into Texas here in the South. Yeah, about third week is when they start coming. And then they're here for a good while and they're noisy and oh, they're great. So since this is our 12th anniversary episode, I thought I'd do some shout outs because we have a lot of people to thank. Especially staff here at Red River Radio and especially Kiara Lafitte, who works the board here and connects callers and conjures up vocalizations we have in the files and plays them for us. So she's working this big motherboard and she does it magically. And we were about 5 minutes late this evening because we had some motherboard problems. So those need fixing. We've got a pledge drive coming up, and that's the way to help keep all this equipment going is to definitely donate some funds, and that's coming up in the next week, the summer pledge drive. Also want to thank, and I will thank our phone bank representatives, especially Caden Cox and Max DeBenedetti. Those guys are very dedicated at answering your calls and patching them through. Also, Les Stewart, big shout out to him for sending email blasts of the show to the birding community. My wife, Julie, ooh, she's very helpful. She edits my scripts and she helps bounce ideas off. We bounce ideas off each other for future shows. Couldn't do it without Julie. James Childress for his great bird photographs that we use on the Bird Calls webpage. Couldn't do it without him. That he gives us a visual presence. Because here we are talking about a hooded warbler, and it's very hard for me to describe this bird. But if you go to our website and look at the hooded warbler there, you'll see what he looks like. And we can thank James Childress for snapping that photograph. And probably 98% of the pictures we've used, I want to say. He's almost at 100%. Also, we use the website xenocanto.org for all their great sound files. Couldn't do it without them. And then lastly, all the guests have been great. We've had, over the years, almost 40 different guests on the show, and it's been great. So thanks to all those. So again, you're listening to Bird Calls. The number here is 800-552-8502. We're gonna play a clip from last month's episode, May 2025, and address a few things. In this clip, you'll hear one of our two in-studio guests from Ecuador, Roanne Wallace, as we're discussing a strange bird of the Neotropics called a common potu. That's spelled P-O-T-O-O. Potus are aerial insectivores that feed at night, and by day, they're well camouflaged, looking like tree bark as they sit on limbs, broken stobs, or even the top of fence posts. Let's listen to that clip here and talk about it on the other side.
The common potu, you said, I know where there is a nest of a common potu, where a common potu roosts, and that's in Saint-Lavie.
Yeah,
yeah, that was it.
Yeah, so a potu, explain what a potu is really quick to listeners.
A frog mouth. Like it's a bird that will sit on a post or a snag of a tree, and you can walk past it hundreds of times and not even notice it. It's just so well camouflaged, but the mouth will open up and it looks like a frog's mouth.
He's a nightjar. He's a caprimulgid. So yeah, related to our backyard chuckwills, widows, and whippoorwills. But yeah, spectacular. Okay, here we are. We're back. The taxonomy of plants and animals is ever-changing. Names are often changed, and based on genetics, there can be a shuffling of which family and order a species belongs. Until very recently, the potu was in the order Caprimulgiformes, commonly known collectively as nightjars and goatsuckers. There are 6 species of potus in the Neotropics, and they're now in their own order Nyctobiaformes. The closest relatives and lookalikes in the U.S. and Canada, as stated in that clip, even though they're in a separate order, include the chuckwills, widow, and whippoorwill, plus the common nighthawk and several others. The term frogmouth that was used in the clip, or that was mentioned in that clip, yet that term refers to a different group of nocturnal aerial insectivorous birds that look superficially like potus, and they occur in Australia, New Guinea, and several islands of Southeast Asia. What I like is that now we're discussing potus, and I'd like to play recordings of 2 different species found in South America with crazy vocalization. And let's listen first to the species that our guests talked about, because we didn't play the recording, and that's the common potu. And you'll hear this in total darkness of the night. Let's listen to the common potu here. That is just a cool, cool sound. Let's listen to one more. Again, that's at night. That's the common potu. And let's listen to the other one I wanted to play called the great potu. And it sounds like, oh, here it is. It's like a mammal-like growl. Here it is. There it is. That's a bird. It'll do it again. Let's wait. There it is. That's the great potu. That's a bird. It's kind of like a mammal growling, and you might, if you hear that, get freaked out and the hair on the back of your neck sticks up, but it's just a fluffy bird, and that's what they sound like, and those are the 2 I wanted to play for you, the common potu and the great potu. Okay, so what's neat is both of the sound files I have come from the website xenocanto.org, which we mentioned earlier, and they were recorded at night in Ecuador by Mitch Leisinger, who coincidentally is a friend of Roanne's, who she mentioned in last month's episode, Small World. In my travels, I've heard both of these species of potus and can tell you that it's a thrill to hear them at night in the tropics in the wild. Okay, you're listening to Bird Calls. I'm Cliff Shackelford, your host. This is a call-in show. Hopefully the phones are working, and let's test them out. Call us, 800-552-8502 with questions. You're burning questions for the summer. Call us at 800-552-8502. And until then, I have some clips to play. Let's do clip 22A. This is a good time to talk about wildlife rehabbers, and we will talk more about it. Let's listen to 2 clips right here. One is a caller, and the next one is a conservation tip on how we should look at wildlife rehabilitation.
Okay, Kenny, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Hey, Kenny, what's up?
I was on a bicycle ride yesterday, and I found a scarlet tanager in the street of a residential area.
Uh-huh.
And he did not look injured. I thought maybe he was ill or stunned, and I picked him up and brought him home, and didn't know what he was. I researched to find out what it was, and I found out they had dwindled in their population because of habitat loss and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And I have been giving him water. He's been drinking water. And I'm not expecting good news, but I was just wondering about, if he has any chance or what I should do to help him, maybe help him survive.
Yeah, so, in the city, he could have hit a window. Doesn't mean he'll fall right down at the base of the window. Sometimes birds get up and can move a great distance from. He could have just had a tussle with a cat. He could have flown low and across the road and got brazed by a vehicle. No telling what, but this really ties into what we talked about in the first couple minutes, is to have that wildlife rehabber number available. And so what you need to do when we're done talking, because time is of the essence, if you're feeding that bird just water, he's going to be dead in about 24 hours. And you're going to have to send it on to a licensed rehabilitator that knows what to do. Because we, you know, our heart is big and we think we're going to help something, but our brain doesn't know really what to do. So that's where your heart, you got to get your heart and brain on the same wavelength. And that's ties back to what I said, is get the rehabber in your area and get that phone number and call them and get that bird over to them so they can do it.
I left an email with the Parks and Wildlife.
Yeah, they're not the right person. Parks and Wildlife is not it.
Just a Google rehab and then get to my...
Yeah. Go to the Louisiana Department of Game and Fish, and they have a website that lists all the rehabbers. So just put in your engine search, Wildlife Rehabilitators and Louisiana, and here comes a list. I just did it today. I checked to see if it's still there, and it'll you can look by where they're located and also what they tend to, because there are some rehabbers that says mammals only or raptors only. So you want to make sure you do get somebody that can do songbirds. And I would say do that right now, because that bird is not going to survive on water, no way.
Right, I understand that.
Okay,
I appreciate that information.
Great, thank you, Kenny. And now we're going to play a follow-up. This is a conservation tip on wildlife rehabbers, clip 22B. This month, we're going to talk about licensed wildlife rehabilitators. So it's important to have certain contact numbers easily accessible for you and your family. Keeping emergency contact numbers stored in your cell phone and in a central location, such as attached to your refrigerator, is always a good idea. These would be phone numbers for your local sheriff's office and your doctors. But what about your nearest licensed rehabilitator? These are the experts you need when you find an injured bird or other wildlife. They're trained and licensed with both state and federal permits. And be careful, however, when determining that fledgling blue jay or deer fawn is orphaned, when in fact their parents might be cautiously watching nearby. Instead, let the parents finish raising their own young. Keep in mind that rehabbers are not government employees, so don't call your local, state, or federal wildlife official, nor are these rehabbers funded by the government. So be sure to include a financial donation when you submit an injured animal or when you feel the need to help them out. To find your nearest rehabber, search for, quote, wildlife rehabilitators in the state of X, end quote, on your computer, and you should be steered to your state's wildlife agency website listing those folks who might be able to assist. Keep in mind that there are large chunks of the country without any local rehabbers, so a long drive might be in order, but don't expect the busy rehabbers to come all the way to you, since they're already tending to other injured wildlife back home. Contact them and work something out, but do it quickly, as injured wildlife might not have long to live. This is precisely why it's good to find your nearest rehabber now, so that when you need them, they'll only be a click away. Do it for the birds. So that aired in March 2017. The caller was, that you heard before that, was May 2017. And so this is a good time to keep rehabbers on the tip of your tongue, because this is when we often see injured wildlife or what we perceive as orphaned wildlife. So have that number handy. Save it now on your phone before you need it, because otherwise you're going to be really struggling and panicking if you can't find that number. So do it now. The website on your state's DNR or your Parks and Wildlife or your Wildlife and Fisheries state agency, they have the licensed rehabbers usually listed. So you wouldn't call the agency. Again, you heard that they're not government employees that do the rehabbing. These are private citizens that have to get a license to do it. They have to show that they've done some training and They've had a mentor to show them the ropes, because this is not something you just do with a big heart. So this is a time of year, again, to make sure you have your rehabber number handy. You're listening to Bird Calls. The number here is 800-552-8502. Call us with your question. Until then, we will listen to some more clips. Let's go to let's talk about Bob White. That seems to be one of our biggest calls and a big issue in the entire southeastern U.S., and that's the decline of the northern bobwhite. Let's listen to clip 14 right here.
Mark. Steve, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. This is Steve. I've had a question that's been bothering me for a long time. You know, you can watch old films, you can see these things, and you can hear in the background Mr. Bob White Quail just a blowing away and having a good time. And you don't hear Mr. Bob White Quail anymore. I don't hear him anywhere I go, whether it's Georgia, Tennessee, Arkansas, Louisiana. I just don't hear him anymore. What happened to him?
Steve, remind me where you're calling from?
El Dorado, Arkansas.
Okay. Yeah, and that's a problem that has been really going, it's really plummeting, that species in our listening area and really the whole southeast. It's basically been extirpated from much of its range. We've basically not done very well maintaining their native grass habitat. That's the big problem. Instead, we've converted it to non-native grasses that are more of a carpet grass that would put the quail on top and running around, whereas they'd rather have the native bunch grasses where there's bare ground that they can run around in between the grasses and therefore stay hidden. They don't like to be on stage. And so that's the big problem with quail. And all the quail hunters know that. There's really just, for Texas, and really nationally, for the South, there's really just two big strongholds left, and that's the South Texas area and also the Wichita Falls area. And there's pretty good strongholds there, and that's because land ownership is large and land owners are keeping it in native for the most part. And those are two huge keys for Bob White. So Bob White won't do well if you only own a few hundred acres. You've got to think big real estate to have quail. So you got to have 5,000 acres minimum before you can even start considering having quail. And that means 5,000 acres of native grasses. And that's just super rare in the Southeast now. It's almost gone. We've completely wiped out the quail's habitat in most of its range.
It sounds like we've just about completely wiped out the native grasses too.
Yes. Yeah. The native grasses that are, you know, acclimated to that soil, to that weather condition, that don't need copious amounts of nitrogen and watering and more fertilizer and more care, that it was just the grass you left alone. So, you know, a lot of people that have hay meadows, which might have been 80 or 100 acres that they didn't mow and didn't convert, those areas right now are some of the last relics of tall grass prairie in parts of Texas. But now in the southeast where we are, the grass would have been under a canopy of pine that was sparsely stocked, very open pine. In other words, you could almost throw a football or frisbee in those forests and not hit a trunk of a tree. The trees were that far spaced because you needed light to hit the ground for those grasses and those forbs to flourish. So we've done away with that. We've cut all those trees down. We've stocked them, super stocked them with lots of trees, and no light gets to the ground, no grass grows, and no quail. So it's really hard to describe to people that quail aren't out in those pastures that we put into coastal Bermuda for cattle. People see those grasslands and say, well, we have grasslands, why don't we have quail? It's not the right grassland. Right. It's not the right grass. It's not the right configuration. It's all wrong. And that coastal Bermuda is an old world species. And here we're taking something from the old world, bringing it here and expecting quail and meadowlark and loggerhead shrike and Henslow sparrow and a whole bunch of others to adapt and change. And it just doesn't happen. So we've done it to ourselves.
So that's pretty depressing. Thanks. So.
Sorry
it
about
is.
That.
And I hate having to be the messenger and the bearer of bad news, but that's such a hot topic, and the quail biologists all know it. But there's really nothing you can do unless you own and operate the land.
And you did give a conservation tip a couple of months ago about planting native grasses if you're, you know, taking over a property or you want a landscape or something like that to bring back some of those natural species and natural habitats.
That's right. And I probably will talk about it more in the future. And so I'm glad that, Steve, you brought it up because it is a huge topic. And people that have lived here their whole lives and they're, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old, they notice that the bird's gone. It's it's the newbies that move here that don't, their barometer starts when they get here. And when they get here, there's no quail calling. So they didn't know what was here before a century ago or half a century ago. But
Yeah, 30 years ago, even. I mean, it's just amazing how quickly
exactly. And so talk to a quail hunter. They'll tell you that they have to travel a long way to hunt quail in a natural setting. Now, I'm not including the put and take situation where you can buy a hunt, go to a place where they release cage reared birds. They release them maybe a few hours or a day before you get there. That's not the same. And I think the hunter certainly knows it. And also, I want to put a shout out that's not a way to put quail back. That these pen rear birds, we don't know enough about them. They could be bringing disease. They could be actually adding to the problem. So I think that we have to get the habitat back before we can get the quail back. And that means we've got to get fire back on the landscape. We've got to get native grasses back. And it's a huge effort and a very expensive effort to do so. And it is depressing. But I'm glad you brought it up because we need to realize that these changes are affecting a whole bunch of things, especially these grassland birds and not just birds, but grasshoppers and other critters too.
Yeah. Well, I sure appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, that originally aired in March of 2016. You heard Bill Beckett, who is a former Red River Radio producer on the show, and he would introduce callers. And so, it's like I mentioned that many years ago, it is really tough to explain to people when they're driving around the Southeast U.S. and they see all these green pastures and they think, why aren't quail out there? It's like I said, it's the wrong species of grass. It doesn't work for quail. They want to be hiding in the on the ground with the clump grasses and not sitting up top of the more carpet grass stuff that we see like Bermuda. And so the sparse trees, the low basal area pine with the grass. So it depends on your definition of a grassland, but some authors still called open pine a grassland because it the vegetation, other than a few trees here and there, was a pure tall grass, almost like a tall grass prairie in some cases, but definitely native grasses and forbs. And it was maintained by fire, frequent fire, to keep pioneering species out. You can see this if you have paid attention in your area, that if you don't burn an open pine stand, it will get flooded with other things like sweet gum and southern red oak, and these are good species to have, but they don't belong in those open pines. And another bird we have lost, especially in Texas, is the Backman sparrow. And that one really relied on those open pine stands with frequent fire. And they are holding on in some cases where you get it a little too shrubby, but if it stays shrubby, they move out. They do not last long, that bird, and we've seen complete extirpation in most of Texas of the Backman sparrow, which is very sad. All right, you're listening to Bird Calls. I'm Cliff Shackelford, your host. Hopefully that's all of our technical difficulties today, but we will see. We're trying to wade through any of these hardball pitches that technology is giving us, but we want to hear from you. Tonight is our 12th anniversary issue, or episode rather. The phone number here is 800-552-8502. Again, 800-552-8502. And until then, we have some other clips we'll listen to. Let's listen to, this is a good one this time of the year. Let's listen to an episode, March 2020, clip number 19, regarding cardinals tapping on your windows.
Jim from Nacogdoches, you have, Cliff, what's your question?
Very, very simple. I've got a male cardinal that visits in the morning and raps on my east window.
Uh-huh.
I've got a large window, and he repeatedly flies from the gardenia
right
up to the side of the house and then starts rapping on the window.
Right. And you think he wants to come in and eat breakfast with you. We hear that a lot. People misinterpret what's going on. And I didn't ask you what you thought about what it's doing, Jim, but I'll go ahead and I'll jump.
I was thinking that maybe he was seeing another male.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You got it right. He sees his own reflection and he's attacking it. We have an Eastern Bluebird male doing that right now. Doesn't hurt himself. He just being a guy and doesn't want another guy in his territory. And that's what your cardinal is doing, just like our bluebird. They're seeing their own reflection and they're attacking it. And with a pea-sized brain, they never figure it out. They never figure out.
Well, that's the thing. I've actually had some larger cardinal stained glass hangings that I brought out, and that scared him off for a little while.
Yeah.
Maybe he was... But anyway,
so
I thought that might be it.
Yeah, and so if it drives people nuts, and it does, if that's your office and you can't concentrate at work, you can take butcher paper or newspaper and tape that up to kill that reflection. You can sometimes do it on the inside of the house, and you got to just go outside to see if that killed that reflection. So if it bothers you, you can tape that up, and it's usually a breeding season type thing. It's usually not year round, but I've seen cardinals, they're a big one, doing this, and they can do it for 6 or 8 months of the year. They just, that's his home, and he sees another intruder just like you and I would, not like anyone walking into our home. That's what this bird is thinking is happening, but he just has a pea-sized brain. He can't put two and two together. So yeah. Well, all right. Well,
I kind of thought that.
But, yeah.
Anyway, well,
cool. Thank you, Jim.
My call.
Thank you. Again, that aired in March of 2020. And I think it was recently I saw a video or a news report that went viral from somewhere in the Northeast where a pileated woodpecker was landing on vehicles and doing the same thing, but looking at its reflection in your side mirror, your outdoor side mirror of your vehicle. And it was cracking them, breaking them, shattering them, because this is a big woodpecker and he's got a lot of power. And people, you know, of course, thinking of mischievous Woody Woodpecker, the cartoon, but this bird, was territorial and saw a reflection and pea-sized brain didn't put two and two together that, hey, I'm looking at a reflection of myself. Instead, he thought it was an intruder and he was whacking at it, and boom, he cracked the glass or the mirror of the side of your car. So if you have a bird doing that, hopefully it's not a pileated woodpecker, but bluebirds and cardinals and mockingbirds will sometimes sit on your side mirror and tap at the mirror. You can throw a towel over that mirror. I know that sounds like, you know, a big hassle, but it's probably better than, you know, if you're having to deal with cleaning up the poop from it sitting there so long, or maybe little scratches, probably smudges is more likely. But that's an easy solution. You can throw a mirror on, a towel over your mirror. If you have, you know, I have a vehicle where I push a button and it retracts, and all of a sudden my side mirrors are almost touching the side of the car and no bird can see its reflection. So that's another option. If you have that in your car, is just close those wings of your windows, or I'm sorry, of your side mirrors, and close those every evening if you have a problem. Otherwise, you know, if you don't mind, it's kind of fun to watch. It's crazy that the birds will do that for hours on end and days and days on end, and they just can't figure things out. They've got that pea-sized brain. I wish they listened to bird calls. They could figure a lot out if they listened to this show. How about that? I'm Cliff Shackelford, your host of Bird Calls. This is our 12th anniversary episode. This is episode 118. And the phone number here, if you have a question, is 1-800-552-8502. Again, that number is 800-552-8502. We've got someone emailed a question in. It says, what bird has the largest recorded wingspan? Is it an eagle? There are a lot of birds with big wingspans. Albatross comes to mind as having a really long wingspan. There are several eagles with big, long wingspans. Whooping crane has a big wingspan. That's one of our, you know, birds in the U.S. American white pelican in the U.S., they have a pretty tremendous wingspan. So, yeah, there are a lot of birds with big, big wingspans. So, we have our first caller. We have Don from Henderson. Don, how are you?
Hey, doing great, Cliff. I've called in a few times before, and I appreciate you telling the story about the bobwhite, the demise of the bobwhite.
Mm-hmm.
Having hunted them with my father 50, 60 years ago and then moving away for 50 years, you know, I can really see the contrast in the habitat destruction that you were talking about. There's just none of these wild pastures anymore. It's all hay or cows on them, so it is sad to see them go. I don't know what we can do about it, but I do appreciate it. And I got a one comment and a question about doves. First, a comment. I used to live in California, and I got to see some condors in their native environment up there at about 6,000 feet. And that was pretty cool to be looking eyeball to eyeball level with a condor flying around. That's got a pretty long wingspan.
Yeah, I didn't mention that one. You're right. There's California condor and Andean condor in South America. They both have very long wingspans. That's right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
And then so you lived here and saw quail and then moved away, and when you came back, there were no more quail. Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, although I realized they had died because I had family here, so it wasn't like I didn't know that when I got back, but I can just see the contrast for having not lived here for 50 years and just how the landscape has changed. You know, it looks good, it's clean, but it's sort of monoculture. There's nothing to support the wildlife. It's all monoculture.
Yeah.
We don't even have the insects that we used to have.
Yeah, that's a good point. The native insects don't match with the non-native grasses and so, but I like your perspective, Don, because you had experience here. You went away and came back, and it was dramatic. And I think of that when we don't see our nephew or niece for many years, and all of a sudden the nephew's 6 foot tall, and you're like, wow, last time I saw you were a toddler. And so, but the parents that see the kid every day, they're like, oh yeah, I guess he is 6 foot tall. I hadn't really noticed, because it's every day you see it, and it's so gradual that it gradually becomes normal to you. But what you saw is drastic, and that's what we need, is, you know, that perspective. Because like I mentioned in the clip, it's the people that are, you know, young or just getting here in this area, their barometer starts when they get here, and so they didn't hear quail because they just moved here a few years ago. Then they have a hard time understanding that this used to be a powerhouse for northern bobwhite.
Oh, absolutely. My dad would hunt them in the morning, hunt them in the night, and I thought maybe he killed them all off. It looks like it's them and the farmers and the ranchers. Insects. I also noticed my dad had a service station, and every time somebody came in to fill up in the winter, summer, you know, we had to scrape those insects off the windshield. They were always dirty.
Yeah.
And nowadays, you can drive a whole gas tank without getting a single insect on your windshield.
Yeah.
So what impact does that have on the rest of the ecosystem and birds not having all of that rich supply of protein?
Yeah, especially when most of our birds, over half our birds, are insect eaters. That is a huge impact, and they're now working on studies in Latin America and the most remote jungles in South America, where birds are declining, yet they have all this protected land And they're starting to see, using black light that attracts insects, they're starting to see a lack of birds coming into the, I'm sorry, insects coming into the black light. So we need to get more entomologists studying this phenomenon of insect declines. We have a lot of bird data showing declines, and we don't have the entomologists doing the same thing. We can do it with birds because we started collecting those data, especially with Breeding Bird Survey back in the 60s. So we have, you know, 50 plus years of that, but with insects, it's a little tougher to look at trends when you don't have that kind of a data set. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Don. Well, thanks for the call, and thanks for your perspective on the Bob White and grasslands in East Texas.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to Bird Calls. The number here is 800-552-8502. We have Sally from Cushing. Sally, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Great.
My question is, I was told several years ago that the reason that the Bob White had gone away in East Texas was because of the fire ants. I grew up in Panola County, and I remember Bob White coming across our yard, you know, in the early afternoon, early evening sort of thing. And now, as you pointed out, there's just no Bob Whites around here. You never hear them call. But I was told that the fire ants ate them. What, if any, impact do fire ants have on not only the Bob Whites, but any other ground nesting bird in our area?
Yeah, that's a good comment. Fire ant is certainly one of the nails in the coffin, but it's not the primary one, like the habitat change, the severe habitat change that we talked about already. But certainly fire ants do have an impact. You know, there's been game cameras put on nests of Bob White around the country where they have found watch fire ants come in and consume the eggs or the nestlings. The fire ants are also competing with the quail. They're eating also insects that should be readily available for the quail to eat. So the fire ant, you know, the fire ant came around and slowly did its thing, but the removal of the native grasses happened a little bit sooner than that. And so the fire ant just became another nail in the coffin, meaning aiding in the decline of the bird. But it, you know, people wanted an easy answer and a quick answer. And so they just said, blame it on fire ants. And that's an easy out, but it's not the complete answer.
Well, I understand that. I'm in my 80s, so I remember a lot of East Texas when it didn't look like it looks now. So, you know, I understand the change of habitat for a lot of our animals.
Yeah.
Birds and, you know, well, insects too, for that matter.
And speaking of the quail, the female on eggs with the game camera, they have footage of the female quail grabbing and eating, not because she wanted to, but that's her only defense. The fire ants, as they're coming towards her nest, as they're trying to get her eggs or nestlings. So they do have a way to combat it, but it can be overwhelming at times. But no, the biggest overwhelming thing has been the loss of habitat, and the loss of habitat came first and was rampant before the fire ant became a thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I appreciate your elucidating that.
Yeah.
For me.
Very good. Thanks for the call, Sally.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye. You're listening to Bird Calls. The number here is 800-552-8502. We got a email from a caller from Shreveport, and it says, I've been seeing a lot of red birds around, and I don't know the name of them. Is this the season for them? And so there's two all red birds in the southeast, and the cardinal is the one that comes to mind first. It has a crest, a little top notch on its top of its head. It has a black mass, the male. The female is not red. She's kind of an orangey brown color, very different. But the all red bird that with a black mask and a crest is a cardinal. The other all red bird that gets here in April and stays with us for 6 or 8 months is the summer tanager. And the male is all red, doesn't have a top notch or, you know, AKA a crest, does not have a black mask. And she, his girlfriend, she is kind of a mustard, spicy mustard yellow color. So she's not red, he is. So I'm guessing this caller that typed in or emailed in is seeing either a cardinal or a summer tanager. And if you go a little farther north in the listening area and up into the Wachitas and even up into the Northeast U.S., there's another red bird that's almost all red, is the scarlet tanager. It's got black wings and a black tail, but otherwise you just see this screaming red bird. That's the scarlet tanager. And we have those in the south as a migrant, but we don't have them as a breeding bird. Okay, let's see. We are wrapping it up here in a second. It's going to be a little short of a show because of our technical difficulties, so sorry about that. We're going to go to our conservation tip. And that is, the title is Rethinking Building Another Public Reservoir. Between the 1950s and 70s, there were many newly constructed public reservoirs intended for water use, recreation, flood control, and generating electricity. To create these, dams were built across rivers that permanently inundated old-growth bottomland hardwood forests. These flooded forests once hosted a majestic ecosystem with hundreds of species of plants and animals that are forever submerged underwater. It's time for a new paradigm, and one that doesn't destroy bottomland hardwood forests. Of course, water conservation, which was a previous conservation tip on the show, is something each one of us needs to exercise, including fixing leaky pipes and shutting off automatic sprinklers and switching to manual. One alternative for the growing need for water is what Tarrant County, Texas has built southeast of Corsicana on land originally cleared for agricultural use. The constructed wetland is owned by the Tarrant Regional Water District and is located on the Richland Creek Wildlife Management Area. The system pulls water out of the Trinity River and cycles it through various wetland cells. The wetland vegetation does the work of removing suspended solids and pollutants from the water before it goes back into their water supply. The mostly shallow water site hosts lots of shorebirds and wading birds and is a fantastic birding area year-round, and most importantly, old-growth forests weren't lost. Let's conserve water, and more importantly, let's not inundate any more of our precious bottomland hardwood forests that are teeming with wildlife. Do it for the birds. Okay, that concludes this evening's episode, which is number 118, and again, our 12th anniversary episode. Sorry for the hiccups, the technical difficulties. Remember, next week is the pledge drive. This is a good opportunity to help us get new equipment. We need your money. If you want your birds, we need some money. Get some new equipment in here. You've been listening to Bird Calls with me, Cliff Shackelford, resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. This show has been made possible in part by the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Tonight's episode was assisted by Kiara Lafitte, and there were several volunteers operating the phone bank. Tonight's sound file of a hooded warbler was recorded by Mike Nelson and can be found at the website zenocanto.org. The photo we used for the warbler on the Bird Calls webpage was snapped by James Childress. This show will be available soon as a podcast on our website at redriverradio.org. If you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you'd like me to identify, you can send an email to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Again, redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Be sure to join us for the next episode of Bird Calls next month at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, July 8th. Do it for the birds.